We are still in this Hebrews template, and this notion of fixing our eyes on Jesus, of course, you know, we can read this and it's just like it's a flyby statement, fix your eyes on Jesus, okay, until we start to see the implications of this. Until we start to see that the implications of looking at someone looking at us, looking at someone at what he is doing, at what his experiences are, and then doing what he is doing. And one of the first things that he does after his baptism, is that he heads into the desert. Jesus is led by the Spirit into the desert. So we move from Luke 3:22 immediately into Luke 4, where we see evidence of the next section of this Hebrews passage, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. So here's the thing. Gosh, it feels good to sit down. Here's the thing. Isn't it interesting that the scripture says that you are not the author of your faith? Jesus is. You're not the one who has to perfect it. Jesus does that. He's doing a lot of this work. Now, I know that, like, this is really, like, you know, you're in the shadow of Dallas Theological Seminary, right? There's, like, the new heaven and new earth, and there's DTS. Where I understand that good theology is taught. And the challenge that we are always facing in the academy, the challenge is that the academy is a good place for us to learn the kinds of things that the left brain is eager to take in. The problem is that that is not the part of our brain out of which we primarily live our lives. We live our lives energized out of our right brain, with our left brain having to make sense of what the right brain sends it. It is important, it is necessary, it is helpful to have good theology. But I want to remind us, that is not where life begins. Life begins with looking at someone looking at us. And it is out of that being seen, being known, that we write good theology. And so when we hear that Jesus is the author and finisher of our faith, that's good theology. But what does it mean? And by mean, I don't mean what does it mean in the dictionary definition of meaning. I mean, how does it have anything to say to my right hemisphere? To the part of my mind that is in charge of my life? Well, I want to invite us to consider this. It's hard for us to imagine that Jesus is constantly authoring things, that he is the one where the energy always comes from, and he is the one who will finish the job. He is the one whose idea it was to write your book, and he is the one who is publishing your book, and he is the one who is editing your book, and he is the one who's going to sell your book, the book of you. It is your job to write. But every time we feel like I'm having to author more faith, my question would be, in that moment, what does it mean for us to practice looking at Jesus, looking at us, and say, like, he says, I know this is hard. I've got this. And what does it feel like when we hear Jesus saying, I've got this. Take the next step. I've got this. Take the next step. I've got this. Take the next step. I'm authoring this. This is not a matter of me just paying attention to some fact. This is me literally, in my imagined mind, in my right hemisphere, I am paying attention to the presence of my God who is actively doing all that is necessary to bring many sons and daughters to glory. Amen. It is not enough for us to simply see that Jesus is the author and finisher of our faith. It is important for us to immerse ourselves in imagining ourselves hearing and seeing him doing that on a moment-to-moment basis. And you'll be wondering, yes, but Kurt, when am I going to balance my checkbook? This will be all I'm doing. I want to suggest to you that if this becomes most of what you do, you will stop worrying about when you will balance your checkbook. And I don't mean because it won't need to be balanced. I mean because there is a lot of energy, so much energy that you have no idea that we burn worrying, that we are then not able to use efficiently to live the life that is before us in the present moment. Does that make sense? This is what shame does. I will not be enough. I am not enough to get my checkbook balanced, and so therefore I don't have time to pay attention to my author. I don't have time to just relax into the hold and the embrace of my finisher, of my perfecter. I don't have time for that. I'm too busy working to perfect things myself. This is what virtually large chunks of the book of Galatians is about. Speaking of like good theology, right? Galatians comes and says, like, y'all are working too hard. The work is being done by someone else. Your job is to pay attention to your being loved. And what work will you not do effortlessly, though with work, when you know you are being loved? When you know that the first thing that you hear when you wake up is, you are my son whom I love, and we've been waiting for you all night. When the last thing you hear before you go to bed, you're my daughter, and I can't believe I got to spend today with you. These are spiritual practices that I want to suggest are not just things for us to do in the privacy of our own homes, in the privacy of our own individual lives. These are things that are intended for us to be practiced, literally, once a week within the context of this cloud of witnesses that you are going to meet with in an embodied way. And you're like, yeah, but my cloud of witnesses, like, one lives in Seattle, and one lives in Pittsburgh, and one lives in, like, Kansas. I mean, like, how am I going to? This is hard to do. This is hard to do. St. Paul, for all of his missional work, never went anywhere by himself. Jesus, for his missional work, never went anywhere by himself except to the cross. Everything else is being done in the context, in the company of other people. Because it's not good for man to be alone. The author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set before him, endured the cross. Can we just say that endurance is not one of our fortes? Right? If you live in an Amazon.com world, endurance is not a forte of ours. Like, we want things done yesterday, now, completely, totally. Endurance is, like, by definition, enduring. It's hard to do. Jesus knows all about this, and he's not worried about it. He knows that endurance is a hard thing to do. How many of us right now have things in our lives that feel like all we're doing is enduring them? I'm going to give you 10 seconds. I want you to take a sheet of paper, and I want you to write it down. Write down two things, if you can, two things that you're enduring. Begin. Done. Imagine how much undercurrent work we are doing where shame is at work telling us that we're not enough, you don't have enough to endure. I want to suggest to you, Jesus knows all about what it's like to have to endure, and he knows this is hard. To wit, he would say, this is hard, let's keep going. This is hard, let's keep going. Enduring the cross, and then there's this really like unbelievable line, right? Scorning its shame. Disregarding its shame. Now, there are implications of these words in the texts. The implications being that if you were to go to a party and your worst enemy were there and you didn't know it, and you went to the party and left the party and you had no engagement with your worst enemy, no one would accuse you of having scorned your enemy. Fair enough? To scorn your enemy would mean that You would go to the party, you would know your enemy was there, you would go find your enemy, and you would say, I want nothing more to do with you, and then you would leave. This is what it means to scorn someone, right? One has to actually approach and then disregard them on purpose. And I want to suggest that Jesus' scorning of the cross's shame is an act in which he voluntarily goes to find it in order to disregard it. And his disregard of it is not because he's simply ignoring it, but because in that moment of crucifixion, he is paying far more attention to his Father than he is paying attention to his suffering. And how does he get to do that? Well, he didn't start that on Good Friday, I will assure you. I want to suggest that this whole process began who knows when, but we know at least it begins in Luke chapter 4. Because I'm going to suggest that when Jesus goes into the desert following his baptism, he does not go into the desert in order to allow the devil to find him. He goes into the desert looking for the devil. Jesus goes into the desert looking for those parts of his own life that he knows are vulnerable. Like, this cat is smart. Jesus is smart. He's smarter than evil, and evil is really smart. And Jesus knows, it seems, that if he's going to do his work, he's going to have to be really aware of his places of vulnerability. The places where evil will come to find him if Jesus isn't paying attention. And so he goes into the desert. And the first thing that he does is that he suffers. He fasts for 40 days. I don't know how many of us fast here. I'm in the process during Lent of trying to fast once a week. I hate fasting. You know when you fast, I don't know if there's anybody here who fasts on a regular basis, but if you fast, you know, most days, you eat your dinner and you're done for the evening and you're not thinking about the rest of the rest of the evening or the next day. You just eat your dinner. You've been grateful. It's awesome. Great. Like, you get up the next morning, you have your breakfast, you go. But on the night before the day I'm going to fast, I eat my dinner and all I can think about is what I'm not going to have to eat for the next day. I'm already missing breakfast and it's only 7 o'clock in the evening. Because to fast means I intentionally put myself into a position in which all of my self-centeredness has no place to hide. If you haven't read Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline, it would be a really good idea. But it won't be all that much fun initially. Because fasting is an example of, meditation is an example of, all these spiritual disciplines are examples of ways in which we allow the Spirit of God to have access to us. To have access to parts of us that we don't know that we don't know. And in some respects, access to parts of us that we very much do know that we don't want him to have access to. But get this, what if we actually decide we're going to fast with other people? What if our cloud of witnesses is going to say, we're going to fast one day a week together? I will tell you that fasting with others is not the same as fasting by yourself. Even if you're going to endure this, if this is going to be hard, then doing something hard together is a completely different experience. This is where the Spirit of God does its work in your cloud of witnesses, and in which you as a group are transformed and bear witness to the glory of God to the people around you who are going to wonder, what's happening with you? Jesus first fasts, he goes into the desert, and then he has these three encounters. And with each encounter with the devil, there is this sense in which the devil poses a question that I would suggest, you know, if you're the Son of God, do this. If you're the Son of God, do this. If you are, it's the same kind of question that the devil throws to the woman in Genesis chapter 3. Is it true? Are you really loved by God in this way? And what does Jesus say? Well, we can say, well, Jesus quotes Scripture, which is true. Jesus is turning to the embodiment of the Word of God. But I want to go further and say this. For a rabbi to quote the Torah For a rabbi to quote that is the same thing, not just as one saying, God says. In Jesus' case, it's like him saying, yeah, that's what you want me to do, but my dad says. How many of us have ever been in situations when you like you really need to like call on the bully buster, right? Somebody's like upsetting you, like you say, yeah, well, my dad says. This is a son who is speaking with the authority of his father's word that is embedded within him and not as some magic talisman. I'm just going to quote scripture and somehow the scripture is going to like blow all this stuff away, make this go away magically. No, this is a sense in which even in that moment of Jesus' attention being drawn to this sense of him being tempted into shame, you're not really his son, are you? Because if you were his son, this is what you would do. This is your opportunity to pick from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. To cope with your concern that I'm raising in your mind by jumping off the temple, by turning these stones into bread, by doing politics the way the world does them. And Jesus is simply constantly turning to his Father, fixed gaze upon him. But Jesus is confronting his shame. He is confronting, not that he carries it with him, he is confronting that space that is tempting him in this direction. He is not waiting for the devil to come find him. He is going to find it. When we scorn shame, it implies that what we have to do is go find it. We have to proactively search it out, find all the nooks and crannies where it lies in order to say to it, you have no place here. Also, in order for me then to be well aware of what's going to happen in the same way that it happened to Jesus. At the end of Luke 4, the text reads, and the devil left him for an opportune time. Jesus goes into the desert to get ready for when the rest of the times that the devil is going to come, and he is coming, and he is coming for you. And if you don't know that, you don't know much. What does it mean for us practically to scorn shame? So here's another exercise that you can do, and then you're going to share this in your great cloud of witnesses. We call it a shame inventory. Sounds fun, doesn't it? You can do this however you'd like. We encourage people to do it in some kind of material that you can get your hands active. It's very simple. You get a stack of, you get 3x5 cards. Right? You can do it on a device, but putting on a stack of cards makes it a little more tangible, a little more earthy, a little more real. And when you begin this process, this inventory, you have your 3x5 card, and at any point beginning in your day that you sense, image, feel, think, or behave in a way that is shaming, I just simply want you to make a mark on the card. I don't want you to write down what it was about. You don't need to figure it out why I did it, what the reasons were behind it, what I need to do to change it. I simply want to make a mark. And then the next time it happens, you make another mark and another mark. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've had people come in and say, like, look, by 10 o'clock that morning, I was done. I'd gone through a half a stack of these cards. Here's the purpose and the point. The point is not to simply point out to you just how shamed you are. This is not the point. We already know that. The point is to interrupt our automaticity in terms of how shame usually operates. For most of us, when we find ourselves in the middle of some kind of shaming activity, no matter how minor and small it is, we don't tend to wake up to it until we are really a long way down the rabbit hole. It is when we begin to interrupt it and simply turn our attention elsewhere that we scorn it. Because when you interrupt it, you're doing something that is playing by the rules of neuroplasticity. You see, if the neuroplastic rules suggest that those neurons that fire together wire together, and I have activated this plastic form of shame, and I'm about to go down this particular well, but I stop it, it prevents that neural network from continuing. And over time, I begin to starve them. Over time, I begin to disrupt the neural activity of how shame wants me to operate. Does that make sense? And you're wondering, well, is that enough? No, it's not enough. I don't want to simply interrupt it. I want to interrupt it in order to completely and continually turn my attention back to, you are my daughter, whom I love, and in whom I'm well pleased. You are my son. Call by my name. You are mine. We turn our attention back to fixing our eyes on Jesus, whose eyes are fixed on us, who is telling us, I could not be more proud to be your older brother. This is not easy to do. You know, because we just keep adding things in your day to do, right? We just keep adding more and more things to do. And we think, like, look, I will be living in a box under a bridge, right? Because I will have lost my job. Because there's all this other stuff to do. And I simply want to say, you will find so much more energy for your job because you are not being burdened by shame. You won't know what to do with yourself. You won't know what to do with all the extra time that you will have on your hands because you will discover how much less time you are spending going down the rabbit hole. But we don't even know that we're going down the rabbit hole because we are not doing the work that is necessary to keep that from happening. This is a whole other story. Technology is a beautiful, wonderful thing. Lots of wonderful things about it. But right now, we are at a point in which, if we're not careful, technology will only ever do that which continues to take us down the rabbit hole. It's not a bad thing. It's a beautiful thing. Evil loves beautiful things. Scorning its shame, this is what it means to do that. To scorn shame. So if we're going to fix our eyes on Jesus and do what he did, it means we're also going to scorn it like he scorned it. We have the task before us in the context of our cloud of witnesses, in the context of our communities, to do the hard work, to do the hard confessional work of identifying where our shame resides. Where is it in our stories? Where is it in our makeup? Where did it happen today? Where do I need to be articulating these things in the context of this confessional group such that I am now no longer being burdened by all the energy that I am burning just trying to manage this? Does that make sense? It will take you perhaps anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks of these kinds of practices before you start to see substantive change. But in that time frame, the change you will see will blow your mind. The hard part is actually doing the work to get there, because it's not easy to do. Because when you leave here today, you will be heading back to what you think is your real life, because you think that you haven't been in your real life in this room. It's true. It's hard to do. And so what else does Jesus do? What else then are we called to do as part of these communities? In John 21, we get a picture of this. In John 21, as you are probably quite familiar, we have the experience of Jesus coming to find Peter. You know, even though Jesus was by this time like walking through doors, right? In John's gospel, they'd already had the appearance of him just showing up a couple of times. Like, dude, like, I don't know how you do it, but like, I want to do this. Like, I want to be able to walk through doors. But even so, somehow the disciples were not yet completely persuaded that life with Jesus was going to go on. And so what do? They go back to their old life, right? They go back to, like, fishing. This is what they're doing in John 21. They're outside fishing. As opposed to inside fishing. I'm not sure how one would do that, right? So, yeah, okay. they're necessarily outside in their boat in the Sea of Galilee fishing. And Jesus shows up and makes them breakfast. And notice what happens. He doesn't just bring them bread, right? He's going to cook fish over a fire. Like, who knows how this guy does this? Right? I'm not quite sure. He's a carpenter. Wood burns. I suppose he would have experience with this, right? I get that. And then he says, come have some breakfast. They see it's the Lord. They walk, they swim in, right? Peter jumps out of the boat. He swims in. And little does Peter know what he is about to walk into. Because they all come in. After Jesus says to them, even though they've been fishing all night, they don't catch anything. Jesus says, cast your nets out on the other side. They do. They catch 153 fish. 53, I think, yeah? I'm thinking, like, in a book like John that's so theologically astute, and they counted the number of fish. Striking to me. I mean, somebody actually took the time. Like, you know how long it would take? Fish are flopping all around. Like, imagine counting all these fish. One, two, no. One, two, three, no. One. They'd have to start over like a dozen times. They probably only caught 15 fish. They just caught, they counted them 10 times over. And in the middle of breakfast, this spread, this welcome time, Jesus begins. This meal, Jesus begins. Peter, do you love me? And then, who knows? Like, three times you go through this. Peter, do you love me? And was it three times? Was it 33 times? I don't know. All I know is that at the very end, the text reads, and Peter was grieved in his heart that Jesus asked him yet a third time, do you love me? And you've heard sermons preached on this. There are whole kinds of reasons for this. But one of the things that we know that happens, that Jesus is setting up, right? There's an open fire going. Jesus is priming Peter's implicit memory. You notice this? Because Peter's denials took place in front of an open fire. Jesus is priming him. Jesus is making sure that everything and anything, any nook and cranny where shame hides out in sensations, in images, in feelings, Jesus is not letting shame hide out anywhere. We're going to excavate this right down to the last molecule of your brain, boy. I am coming for you. And he asks him three times, and by the time he gets to the third time, and Peter is grieved in his heart, this is what strikes me. Like, if I'm Peter, and I'm grieved, I know why I would be grieved. I'm grieved not just because I'm doubting Jesus' confidence that I do. I'm grieved because I know that Jesus knows that I don't love him. I know I'm saying that I do love you. Of course I love you. Of course I love you. The whole time, the fire reminding me of my denials. How many of us say we love Jesus, and the whole time there is that bark in the back of our head saying, well, what about this? What about that? What about that unfinished business relationship? What about this place where you haven't worked hard enough for God lately? You know what I mean. It's that shame attendant who is talking to you all day, every day. The whole time I am saying I love you, I have something else talking outside of me that is saying, do you really? How many times do we have experiences in context of relationships with people that we love who, in that very context, their coming to find us activates parts of us that we're just not very proud of? And we would much rather those parts have just stayed away. But here's the thing. Jesus has no intention of leaving any stone in your heart, mind, soul unturned. He is coming for everything. Now, there's an interesting thing that happens with Jesus and Peter in this whole scenario. Every time Jesus asks Peter, and Peter says, yes, I love you, what does Jesus do? He says, feed my sheep, feed my lambs, tend my lambs, tend my sheep. And I want to invite us to consider that this scene is where the rubber hits the road in terms of what God wants to do with our shame. You see, in that space, Jesus was once again exposing, in what it seems to me, Jesus was exposing Peter's shame to himself and frankly to everybody else. Because you can imagine, if I'm Peter, I would much rather this conversation go something like this. We get over to the shore, we have breakfast, and then Jesus like takes me off by ourselves. And he says to me quietly, hey, you know that thing that happened 6 weeks ago when you threw me under the bus? We're good. Just letting you know, we're good. Jesus, like, Jesus, hey, where'd you and Pete go? Oh, Pete, oh, no, no big deal. I had to go to the bathroom. If I'm Peter, I don't want this done in public. But if I'm Jesus, it needs to be done in public because it was done in public. And why is that? Because Jesus knows that if this remains private, it will be really easy for Jesus and Peter to have their own little private conversation about Peter's shame, and all the other disciples will still know that he threw Jesus under the bus. They will all still know, and they will all still wonder, and they will all still suspect him. When is he going to do it again? Jesus knows that if Peter is going to be his first lieutenant, he needs everybody to know that he's going to be his first lieutenant. And he needs them to know that Jesus himself is not ashamed of Peter. He needs Peter to know that publicly. Are you with me? How many of us are terrified that anyone would know of our shame privately, let alone that it would be put on public display, only to have someone say, we know about your sin, and we have work for you to do anyway. You see, because what happens here? When Jesus says to Peter, do you love me? And Peter is grieved in his heart. Jesus is intent upon drawing Peter's attention to the work that Jesus has for him to do. Jesus is saying to Peter, I know you're ashamed, and I want you to stop paying attention to that and pay attention to me and the work that I have for you. And I want everybody else here to know that I'm giving Peter marching orders. I'm not afraid of what he did. I'm not afraid of what you did. I'm not afraid of what you will do in the future. I'm not worried. I've got this. Jesus gives Peter his vocational commissioning. Peter thinks that what he has to do is just go back to fishing. And Jesus is all about commissioning him to doing something completely new in the face of his shame, in the presence of his memory of it. And this is what neuroplasticity does for us, right? When we have a story that we tell that is only one of shame, and that's all we can have in our head, that's the repeated mantra, that's the neuroplastic practice that goes on in my brain. And I look at someone and I tell them my story, and instead of seeing, feeling, sensing shame from them, I sense something else. I sense them saying, your older brother Jesus, he's coming for you. Our brain doesn't know what to do with that kind of grace. We call it grace. I want to tell you, like, grace is a theological term. As far as our brain is concerned, you can call it whatever you want. What our brain knows is that somebody is looking at me, talking to me, and that person is Jesus coming to find me. Who will be your cloud of witnesses who will be doing that? And so part of what we do in this cloud is that we come to find people in their shame. Like, are you serious? You mean people are going to ask us questions? How are you doing? What are you looking for? How's your shame today? We're not looking for you to tell us so that we can shame you. We're looking for you to tell us so that you are not imprisoned by it, but rather you are going to be continually recommissioned to do the things that you are called to do in your vocational callings. This is all about the God of the universe recreating the world so that we can live like God lives. In this dance of the Holy Trinity. And what then does it start to look like in communities? If you practice, if we as communities practice what Jesus and his disciples were practicing in John, what the Hebrew, what the writer of the Hebrews talks about, if this is what our practices are, we get 1 Corinthians 12 and 13. In verses 14 to 24 of the 12th chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul, without using the word shame anywhere, deconstructs it. When he basically says, look, we're all part of one body, and the head of the body is Jesus. And there's no body part, first of all, that can say, well, I'm not good enough to be part of the body because I'm not this or that or this or that. I don't belong here. That's shame talking. That's self-condemnation. And then he gets halfway through this passage, and he says, neither can we say, well, because you're not one of us and one of this and one of that and so forth and so on, you don't belong here. That's also shame talking. That's condemnation of the other. And Paul is saying, that's not how we live here. In the body of Jesus, we live in such a way that the parts of us that are most vulnerable, he says this, right? The parts that are the most vulnerable get special attention. The parts of my heart that are most vulnerable, the parts of my heart that are most easily shamed, those are the parts I really don't want any attention paid to at all. I'd rather not go there. I don't want to be writing any autobiography and reading this to people for crying out loud. They start asking you questions. Let's imagine something. Let's imagine for a moment that you have someone in your church who's committed adultery. You ever been in a church where someone commits adultery? If not, then you don't go to church. Nope. Happens everywhere. And adultery is a big deal. And adultery has a lot of shame wrapped around it, as sex in general does. We could have a whole weekend conversation about that alone, sex and relationships and where it shows up and all kinds of things. But what would happen if we would have this scenario? What would happen if the person who had committed adultery wants to come clean about this and wants to no longer be ashamed about this? Wants to no longer be ashamed. And in order to do that, we're going to call it a man. It could be anybody, right? It could be a male, could be a female, could be a husband, could be a wife. And let's say that they're going to come before your church publicly. And they're going to stand at the pulpit, and they're going to read their confession. But standing behind them is every single elder in the church. Every single deacon. And we're saying, we are for you. We are for you. We are with you. We're not minimizing this. In fact, the confession itself is evidence of how seriously we take this. Right? Because we don't live in a world in which we want to publicly confess anything unless we're a politician. Right? Because then we get to lose our office, but then we get a book deal, and then we get a movie deal, and all kinds of things. We become a consultant. But then imagine this. Then imagine this. What if it's not just the elders and the deacons? What if, after having spoken with their appropriate family members, every other man in that congregation who's ever committed adultery stands and comes up and joins that person on the platform? Because if we're going to take this seriously, if we're going to take the Sermon on the Mount seriously, That means that just because this one person who got caught like doing real adultery, if he's going to confess, so is everybody else. And now you've got 100 men on the platform. And they all haven't cheated on their wives. No, they've looked at pornography. They've done other, they have a range of different things, just in their head. But they're like, I am an adulterer. Jesus said, if you look upon a woman with the intention to lust after her, you've committed adultery and you are in danger of the court. Dan, you know what that means? Stoning. What would it be like for us to take our confessional union so seriously that we aren't just going to let one person be the scapegoat for all of our sin? Did I tell you that this is hard to do? This is really hard to do. Or we could switch it to a different topic, the topic of gossip or the topic of greed. There's one. It doesn't have to be, like, we could name a number of things that we are sinful of, that we have shame about, but that we privatize. And Jesus, with Peter's reinstatement, is not allowing this to remain private. And in so doing, liberates the whole kit and caboodle of them. And imagine how much energy we burn just managing all of that stuff. And what would it be like if we were no longer managing that stuff, but instead we were hearing the voice of those around us, being the voice of Jesus saying, I have work for you to do. I want you not to minimize sin, not to pretend as if you didn't deny me three times. We're not pretending that. We're saying, of course you did. We know this is hard. Now I have work for you to do. Pay attention to me paying attention to you. If you start to do this, it will drive evil crazy. And it will come for you. This is not easy to do. But that is the kind of community in 1 Corinthians 12 that we see. This is the body of Jesus at work. And then we get to 1 Corinthians 13, and what do we see? We see that if we're going to do this work that he calls for in chapter 12, we're going to have to behave like chapter 13 asks us to behave. All those things that love is. And what does it do when it reaches its zenith? Love at its zenith is something that brings us into this place where in that day we will know even as we are known. To be known is to be loved. To be loved is to be present with that part of our body and that part of ourselves that is the most vulnerable in the context of community, in order for it to be an explosive outpost of goodness and beauty that bears witness to the kingdom of God that is and is yet to come. And it takes hard work. But in the context of community, that hard work is constantly being transformed into joy. The fifth chapter of Romans tells us this much. That we stand in this faith. And in this faith that we stand in, where there's no condemnation, we glory in the hope of God. But as we said yesterday, we glory not only in the hope, but we glory also in our sufferings. This work that you're about to do is work that may bring suffering because you're going to push against a world that does not want you to do it. And suffering produces perseverance. There is that word again. Suffering produces repeated practice in the present moment. Not allowing my attention to move to the future where I worry or the past where I regret, but in the present moment, where is the only time that I have where God's operating with me? Perseverance, which produces, perseverance produces character, right? Suffering produces perseverance, and perseverance leads to character. And what is character? Character is the repeatedly enlarging, developed resilience of the fruit of the Spirit. It is an ever-enlarging, mushrooming collection of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Mind you, there is no such thing as love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, self-control. Those are abstract words that should be describing our behavior. There is not love, there is loving action. There is not kindness, there is only kind action. Kind action given to you and given to me. Action that I exert toward you and action that I exert in my own mind toward myself. These are embodied behaviors because if I'm going to love the Lord my God with all of my mind, I have to remember it is an embodied phenomenon. It's not just something that is in the ether or abstract. This is what character is. Character is resilience embodied. And character leads to hope. And what is hope? You know, yesterday we talked about how what we pay attention to, we remember, and what we remember becomes our anticipated future. Hope is the anticipated future of the things that we have practiced. Hope is the anticipated future of the things that we have practiced. Think about it. If I am practicing staying in the present moment, looking for my God to be present with me here and now, that becomes what I remember. I remember a series of moments in which I'm not anxious. And if this is the story of my life in which, no, I haven't been anxious for the last several days because I'm repeatedly staying in the present moment, this becomes now what I anticipate my future will be. Hope is the only choice I will have. And the most recent NIV version, I love this. The next to most recent version says this, and hope does not disappoint. Hope does not disappoint. But the most recent version says this, hope does not put us to shame. Because the word disappoint in English and in our alliteration, in our connotation of that word, disappointment is all about shame. Hope does not put us to shame. If I am focusing my attention on that which brings me to a place of hope because of persevering resilience, shame is not possible to be had, and evil is left with no room to breathe. This is what healing looks like. And this is what it means to commission, like Jesus commissions. What will you want to do differently, vocationally, in those multiple different domains? What do you want to do differently after this weekend that before this weekend you were not willing to take the risk in doing because shame had too much of a talking stick? This is not just about healing, which it is about. It is about commissioning. Jesus is not just about Peter feeling better about himself. Jesus has work for people, for Peter to do. And where does that all leave us? Your last little bullet point there. I just have some additional things that I've got another book project that's coming out in a little bit, and I just want to just run this thought by you. All this work that you're doing, I would suggest, God finds to be eminently beautiful. Now, beauty isn't a word that many of us are actually very comfortable with in our culture. And in fact, in the academy, if you say that something is beautiful, you'll be run out of town because, of course, to say that something is beautiful means that you're rendering an opinion, which means that something else might not be. You can say that something might be beautiful if one could only consider it from my perspective, but we postmoderns would suggest that to say that something is beautiful is a judgment. We couldn't ever consider that beauty was just like self-evident, it's beautiful. We can't really say that. Psalm 27:4 tells us something about beauty, tells us something about what all this work that we've been talking about this weekend is about. There's one thing I ask, the psalmist writes. To be in the presence of your temple, to be in your temple, and to gaze upon your beauty. It's the one thing I ask. And here's the thing. It's not just that we gaze upon the beauty of God. That is part of it. It is our gazing upon God's beauty in his delight in gazing at us. Do you get that? God's beauty is as much about his delight in gazing at us. One thing I ask, to be in your temple, that I might gaze upon your beauty. Fast forward to John chapter 2. Jesus, in John's gospel, is clearing the temple, and he says, tear this thing down and I will rebuild it in 3 days. We have moved now from the Old Testament to the New, in which Jesus is helping people transition. The writers of John's gospel are suggesting that the psalmist's request for God to allow him to be in the temple is now being moved not to a place but to a person. And that person has beauty about him, and his beauty is also being given to us as he views us because he believes we are beautiful. Far more so, I would dare say, that most of us in this room believe we are. Tear this temple down, and in 3 days I will rebuild it. And we move from John 2 to Acts 2 and Pentecost, when this wind sweeps, not unlike Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. And there was a wind from God that swept over the deep, and life and light and goodness and beauty came into being. And now we move from Jesus being the temple to the temple being the people of God. And then we get to 1 Corinthians 12. Do you not know? You are the body of Christ. We are the body of Jesus. So this body that Jesus talks about, that is beauty embodied, which was what the psalmist asks to dwell in, has now been transferred to us. Are you with me? For us to flourish, for us to have lives of goodness and beauty means we see and find beauty in each other. We are the body of Christ. And then we move to Revelation chapter 3, where Jesus is talking to the church at Philadelphia. And he says, to those who conquer, I will make of you pillars in the temple of my God. We come back to the very notion of a building like we started with back in the Psalms. And I want to suggest that all this hard work at excavating, at scorning shame, at living this out in the context of a cloud of witnesses is to do so in order to create outposts of goodness and beauty. And I want to say to us, that there are those who believe that in the next 25 to 50 years, that the notion of beauty will be one of the single most important elements that we in the church offer to the world as the tool of evangelism. And I want to suggest to you that you are that beauty. I want you not to forget it, but rather to live into it. I'm going to wrap up with this admonition. from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. At least that's how I think they pronounce his name. He's French. Beautiful names. I can't pronounce them. Above all, trust in the slow work of God. We are quite naturally impatient in everything to reach the end without delay. We should like to skip the intermediate stages. We are impatient of being on the way to do something unknown, something new. And yet it is the law of all progress that it is made by passing through some stages of instability, and that it may take a very long time. And so I think it is with you. Your ideas mature gradually. Let them grow. Let them shape themselves without undue haste. Don't try to force them on as though you could be today what time, that is to say, grace and circumstances acting on your own goodwill, will make of you tomorrow. Only God could say what this new spirit gradually forming within you will be. Give our Lord the benefit of believing that his hand is leading you, and accept the anxiety of feeling yourself in suspense and incomplete. I'm going to stop with that, and we're going to go to our time of Q&A, which we will have for about 30 minutes. And at 4:30, we'll wrap up, and we'll have some time for book signatures. And Dan, where am I going to sign books? Out there. Okay. So when we're done at 4:30, I'm just going to grab my stuff and go without answering questions so we can get out there and do that. Yes, I will. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, right? Somebody, anybody else, you can say. I will. Pierre. P-I-E-R-R-E. P-I-E-R-R-E. Teilhard. T-E-I-L-H-A-R-D. It's one word. De, D-E, Chardin. C-H-A-R-D-I-N. He was a Jesuit priest, brilliant writer. I'm sorry? It's called A Patient Trust. And it comes from a prayer book titled Hearts on Fire, Praying with the Jesuits. Man, you all have worked hard. You've worked hard. Yes. Right. I'm sorry?
You quoted an author, Laird.
Martin Laird. Right. Into the Silent Land. Martin Laird. It's a small book, easy to read. You could read it in a couple of days. It'll take you a lifetime to practice. Hey, you know what, Scott? Oh.
Okay, how do your spouses figure into the group who you know and who by whom you are known? Because you said to reach out to three people. Okay, I'm thinking you should have typically a good relationship with your spouse where you know them and they know you, but maybe there's areas that you haven't shared. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking that's a place to start, but I'm wondering how that factors into the three people that you say you reach out to, because I'm thinking at home is kind of the primary place to start.
Right. So the question is, what do we do about the challenge of how we navigate marriage, right? Like, what if, like, who if of those folks who are going to be part of our cohort, is that, does that person, first of all, have to be our spouse? It seemed, in some respects, it would make sense that they would be. It's also, I think, true that many people would say, like, you know, there are sometimes things, so I'll tell you my story. I have a spiritual director, an Anglican priest that I've met with now for about 20 years. I meet once a month on average. And I have a group of men, two other men that I meet with every Tuesday morning for prayer and confession that we've met with for about the same amount of time. And there are things that we talk about in those groups that I don't necessarily talk about all the details with my wife, Phyllis. But there's nothing general, but the general topics about my life that my wife doesn't know about, if that makes sense. So it is true that there are going to be some topics, for instance, that some of these folks may be more able to understand and comprehend, help you work through that than even your own spouse. And especially in those marriages where, for some reasons, you may have certain things that are just not that in common for you. But I want to say that anything that we are doing in this cloud of witnesses, if that cloud does not include your spouse, should necessarily be doing work that draws you to much more easily be transparent with your spouse, if that makes sense. We're working on these things in an effort to be working on these things more effectively everywhere. So, for example, when we talk about creating confessional communities in our nonprofit that we've talked about, the Center for Being Known, one of the things that we want to do, you can learn more about that at the information on the table. One of the things that we want to do is we want to create confessional communities in systems that are not just small groups for churches. We want to create systems where this works if you work at a school or if you work at a law firm. Because the reality is, in any vocational domain that we occupy, we're going to have interactions with people in which shame is going to want to set up camp. I mean, how many of us work in businesses where, like, we are managed by people where, like, shame is rampant? Because we don't know how to operate shamelessly, effectively, even in a business or a school setting. It's hard for us to do that. And so, any place that we, and it doesn't mean that if I'm, like, so in our practice, we have a private practice and there's seven of us that meet every Wednesday for staff. We're pretty transparent with each other. Now, that doesn't mean that we're transparent with each other about all of our personal items, but it means that we are completely transparent with each other about all the things that have to do with the work that we do together. Does that make sense? But shame doesn't want us to do that. Like, shame will keep us from being that transparent, even in places where it should be the case. So my point being that no matter where we are doing our primary work, that work is intended to help us do that work that much more effectively in all of the domains that we occupy, including our marriages, if that makes sense. I mean, each of us are going to have different ways of answering that question, and we might be worried because, oh, this is another thing too. Like, we live in a world in which, as we said yesterday, marriage has kind of become like the relational holy grail. And if you don't have the perfect marriage in which your soul is completely and totally understood by that person, then you don't have a healthy marriage. Do you know that like 200 years ago, it was largely the case that most people's best friends in Great Britain were not their spouses? It was never expected that they would be. In the healthiest of marriages, God-fearing marriages, faithful marriages, some guy's best friend would be some other guy. We wouldn't know what to do. Like, pop radio would go out of business, right? Because we wouldn't know how to write songs about people being best friends with somebody who's not your spouse. Because the Bible doesn't talk about marriage being a place to find your best friend. The Bible talks about marriage being a place for you to love the other, if you're men, as Christ loved the church. The Bible talks about marriage being this thing where we are, we said yesterday, like, marriage is death, right? We said this, but you laughed more yesterday. But this is just one example of how We may not have questions that are all so neatly packaged and wrapped in their answers when we start out on this journey. And the reason is because we don't have a lot of working models for this, you know, to work out all the kinks. But I would suggest that, like, we try this and try this and try this, like we say in recovery rooms, right? You share and then you check. You share and then you check. You share and see how this works, and then we'll see if it works, and if it doesn't, then we're going to correct for the problems that it has, without letting shame even be part of the conversation in terms of how we correct the mistakes that we discover that we make.
Forgive me, as I'm not sure that I have this well formulated. But what keeps coming to mind as you're talking about the shame and taking this weekend and kind of looking at it personally to seek to apply these things. I am curious or haven't well formalized in the area of, say, what I as an individual or maybe even say us as a primarily Christian group would find as maybe the kinds of things that would possibly create shame down the road. Primarily the area, say things in the area of sexuality. Mm-hmm. We live in a world where there's a large bulk of the people that would say that those same things, there's nothing wrong with them, and they would not create shame if we as Christians would not put the shame on them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, I'm not quite sure what I'm wondering, but where... How does that work? Like,
right, because it's kind of hard to just kind of like put it out there, isn't it? Because it's, yes. Like, it's too, we're too afraid that we're going to offend somebody in the room.
Well, I'm not, maybe, and I don't realize it, but.
Right, let me just, you sound like a pretty smart person. No shame.
Thanks.
Right, okay. Right.
Can I try an example, maybe?
And the fact that we have a hard time putting words to this is not because we're not smart enough.
It's just big.
It's big, and we're uncomfortable with the topic. Right? It's hard. Difficult? I mean, right?
Yeah.
It's hard. Okay. So there will always be things in the world. I mean, one of the things that sets, I mean, regardless of where we are around sex, and so this is just my, you know, kind of, this is kind of where I am and how I, in my hermeneutical context, because nobody reads the Bible by themselves, right? We always read the Bible in the context of other people who are helping us learn about the Bible and so forth. Like, nobody reads it by themselves. But I've been influenced by a number of different people who would suggest that the Bible read most plainly would suggest that if you read that, not just the Bible, but the history of the Bible in the context of the Christian, Hebrew and Christian communities, the thing that tends to set Christianity apart, tends to set Judaism apart, is what we do with sex. And the reality is that from the biblical perspective, sex has lots of no around it. No. Lots of no. Not K-N-O-W. The word no. Right? The Jews were that group of people in the ancient world that, like, weren't permitted to do things the way everybody else was doing them. And that has never changed. But I want to suggest that, and so many of us in this room, maybe not all of us in this room, have a particular perspective on this, in which we would say there are certain things that we say no to, right? We talk about no being at the center of who we are. And I would suggest, right, we live in a world, but our world is not that different from where our world was 2,000 years ago. It's really not. But we live in a world in which our sexuality is kind of central to our identity. Like, we kind of do lots of different stuff wrapped around that. And the Bible's actually pretty clear about, like, that's not cool. And it's not cool because, like, that's a bad thing to have happen. It ruins us if we do this. That's why it's a problem. It's not a problem because, like, it's some random law. The question then is going to be, if I am someone who's going to say no, because what did we say? What is shame? In terms of the biomechanics of shame. Shame is not the process of saying no. Shame is the process of saying no in the absence of a clutch. So there's a story. I'll tell you this story, and you might know this story, right? It's the story of, anybody, if you follow basketball, right? And you know Bill Walton and John Wooden. John Wooden, famous coach from UCLA. There's a famous story of Bill Walton, his All-American center, who comes in his senior year, just before his senior year, and Bill Walton is a consensus first-team All-American, but it was the 70s and it was UCLA, and Bill Walton came in, long hair, beard, and he came to John Wooden's first practice. And of course, if you know much about John Wooden, who was a believer, also had some rules about practice and about his teams. Haircut, certain esprit de corps, a whole range of things. But Bill Walton figured, and this was later on an interview between the two of them, Bill Walton figured, I'm going to come to practice and I'm going to tell the team what I think, because he was a captain for the team. And he said, Coach, I have some things I want to say to the team. And Coach says, well, fine, this is before the first practice of the year. They'd won like a string of national championships, and right, and Walton was like one of the best players that the world had ever seen at that point. And so Walton gives the team his speech about all the different things that the coach should be doing differently and the freedoms that they should have and so forth and so on and so forth and so on. And he gets done, and Wooden even comes back and says, is there anything else, Bill, that you would like to say? He said, no, I'm done. I have everything to say. Thank you very much. And Walton says later, I fully expected Coach Wooden to say, well, at least to say, I'm going to have to think about this. Or to say, well, I think there are some suggestions that you think that would be pretty good. Instead, he says this, Bill, thank you so much for your thoughtful offerings. The team is going to miss you. Just like that. And 45 minutes later, Walton was back with his hair cut and beard shaved. But this doesn't happen in one conversation. This happens because over 5 years before this, as he was being recruited in the 3 to 4 years that he'd been playing for Coach Wooden, Wooden had poured himself into this guy over and over and over and over and over again. We talk about these kinds of conversations and shame and so forth largely because, and problematic, largely because we are not embedded in the conversation with people before we ever get to the talking about sex. By the time we get to a place where we talk about sex, it's possible that we may say no, like Wooden says to Walton. But we say it in such a way that if people feel ashamed, if people feel bad, it may be because they live in a world where we are learning that to say no is to say you're not loved. And the biblical narrative would suggest that no is at the center of what it means to be loved. And so for us, it's really a matter of how do we have the conversation in which we can continue to say, I want you to be at my dinner table while we talk about the things that I don't think are okay to do sexually, but I want you at my dinner table. No, I want you at my dinner table. It's a hard conversation to have, one that's going to become increasingly difficult for us to have, but not difficult because we don't know what to say, difficult because we ourselves have a hard time managing our own discomfort. Does that make sense? Which is why we need to be learning how to manage this in community, doing the things that we're talking about. But it's not just about sex. It's about how we are with everybody about everything. But because sex is physically and biologically kind of at the very center, it is the most intimate physical thing that we have that represents the core of who we are. That's why it's important. But not because it is like super important, but because of what it represents for us physically. Okay? Yes.
Time, please share the outcomes of your two patients.
Oh, John and, yeah. Okay. Rats. So first, Steve, our father who lost a son to hanging. So one of the things that we did with Steve, because... he was willing to pay attention to the science. And the science eventually led to us saying, look, if you really want to do this work well, it would be best to do it in a group. And I run a men's group. And in that men's group, John, for the very first time, had people, other men, ask him, so dude, like, what's up with you and your parents? He's in his 50s, right? Nobody's asking him this question. And you see, the thing about being in a group where this happens is it's one thing that we tell people, if you want to join one of our groups, we can probably get done in 8 months in a group what it would take 5 years to get done individually. Because the brain has this odd way, if you're seeing somebody in psychotherapy and I, you know, you're my therapist, after even a short period of time, my brain is kind of dialed in on you and I'm trying to like work to make sure that I know what you're doing and so forth, even if I'm not aware that I'm doing this. But it's tough for me to keep track of 7 other people in the room who are coming to find me, right? I didn't see that question coming from my right flank. I didn't really comprehend that in the course of telling my story, I could have this kind of impact on other people who are being invited to talk about what it's like for me to tell my story and what that does to them. You see what I mean? And so part of what Steve was opened to, and his scientific mind had, you know, had to do some work in this, he was opened to the reality of data. And the data that he had was that his experience with other people in community was changing his brain. And for the first time, he was able to recognize that truth was not just something you figure out in a test tube. Truth was something that one discovers in the presence of another person who's coming to find you. Truth is not so much a noun, it is an adverb. It is about living truly. And truly living means to be living in a context of people who come to find you, and when they find you, they don't shame you. Even when you tell them, well, I don't really believe in God. And they're like, okay, next question. Because his only experience of people who believe in God is that there's an immediate response of shame, right? In some respect, well, you think that I'm not smart enough, which is why I got to come up with all the reasons why I don't believe in God. Until he finds out that God is, and his belief in God is far more connected to his unfinished business with his parents, let alone having to work through the grief of his son. And so he worked through one trial with this group of about 8 months. And then we continued to see each other. And what I would say is that his work continues to move in which he's gradually considering the possibility of attending a church. But not because he's fully converted, but because this is a guy who's gradually doing the work of moving away from shame to connection with other people. And this group that he's part of continues to meet after we're done. We finished that, we wrapped that up. So he's being loved by people in ways that his 10 and 13 and 17-year-old self needed to be loved. And he's also started to have some conversations with his elderly parents that heretofore he's never had. Now, who knows where that'll end? With John, I will say this. John's situation was difficult in the example that I gave to you was one of literally dozens of events that were like unto it. For John, it has been a number of years worth of just him getting to a point where he's able to actually identify things that he feels when he feels them. Because it takes this long to do. Now, John's a person who's he's a person of faith, and he believes in God, and he attends a church, and he's part of a Bible study. But he's in a marriage that is a wreck. And he doesn't know what to do about that. And so you see, even though he's doing all the right things as far as his church attendance and so forth is concerned, part of what's difficult for him is getting his right brain online because there has been so much trauma. He doesn't act out. He's not enraged. He's just like offline. Because to remember things, to come back to things that feel this difficult, like he would have to experience, would be really scary to do. Even in the context of a group for him, practicing, paying attention to those kinds of traumatic things is hard to do. So we are reminded of Chardin's words when he says, like, this takes a long time. Don't be impatient with God's work. You know, as therapists, like, we also get impatient. Because if a patient isn't making progress, like, it's like a reflection of me, right? It's my fault. Like, I'm not smart enough, not effective enough, not whatever. Like, and it doesn't matter that I've had 25 years of experience doing this and that I've known that I'm not supposed to be worried about these things. It takes God a long time, blah, 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 right? No. I mean, somewhere in the next month, it'll find me again. Yeah.
I just want to first tell you, you did a beautiful job of integrating both the science of psychology and faith. A lot of times you either have one and the other is lost. Yeah.
Oh, thanks. Well, that's very kind. Thank you.
But ultimately, as a clinician, the people that struggle the most with seeking out treatment are believers. Because there is this ultimate idea that if you're struggling, that you should be able to take it to prayer, that you'll be able to do that at the church. Mm-hmm. So what do you say to believers that seek out help and they struggle with the stigmatization in the world, but they struggle with the shame in the church? What do you say to them?
Don't be so stupid. What's wrong with you? That's right. Stop it. Right. Right. It's good. It's good. So it's not easy, but it's not complicated. And that is this. The reality is that we find ourselves in that place. People of faith find themselves in that place. Because we in the church have been drinking the modernity Kool-Aid for 400 years, right? In which modernity and post-modernity, where we kind of separate, right? The material world from the universe. Like a Jew, a first century Jew, like a second century BC Jew, this notion that there is a spiritual and a physical world would be a bit nonsensical to them. Like all of the world is God's. Okay? So we've created these notions of abstraction wherein which we would say there is a spiritual realm in which certain things occupy that, like prayer and God. And then there's like the physical realm. And God doesn't occupy that. That's not spiritual. You with me? And this is, first of all, a miseducation theologically for people about Paul's language. Because for Paul, spiritual was not non-material world. Spiritual was the world of God, including material world. Right? Flesh was not the material world for Paul. Flesh was the non-God world, the world of darkness. So there's been a miseducation of patients around that question. But a second thing is this. We live in a world of opportunity, meaning that when we find ourselves interacting with folks who are struggling with this matter, my invitation to them is to take, is to try to do what we've been doing here. Like we're gonna talk with people, invite them to consider how science speaks but through the lens of the biblical narrative, right? We would say, well, here's what the science is telling us. The science is telling us that this is one way to think about the mind. But we're not just talking about science, we're also talking about how that fits through the lens of the biblical narrative. And whoa, don't you know that like there's Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and Genesis 3. You follow me? There are, the scriptures are replete with ways that we can mine that to talk about science through a biblical anthropology that gives authority to people who are worried about this. But it also means that people in this profession find themselves probably in the position of educating people about what spirituality really is. And that's because, unfortunately, we have experiences within churches in which there has been a dichotomization, right? This separation between what is spiritual and what is material, if that makes sense. And our job is to talk like the Bible talks. I don't know if that's helpful. Yeah. Have people read my book. That's what we'll do.
I have another question. So The story that you shared about skiing kind of brought up...
Oh, you're bringing that up again.
Yes, yeah. just this idea of just over the last couple of years doing a lot of my own heart work, I think thanks to my wife and others, but realizing that a lot of my own shame came from this sense of my dad kind of not coming to find me uh-huh. and then hoping that other men in my life would do the same. And through some of that healing, realizing or being able to realize, you know, my dad didn't come for me because somebody didn't come for him.
Right.
My pastor didn't come for me because somebody didn't come for him. And now I spend a lot of time with business leaders, with pastors, and I see that cycle over and over again.
Right.
And I guess what I heard in your story was this great, you know, you have this 78-year-old, 72-year-old, and there's this natural sense in our story when, at least I think for men, when an older man comes in, like, that guy can be my guide. I can figure it out with that guy. But I'm 29, and I sit down with a lot of these guys, and I don't know, like, I don't know what to say. It's like instead of, you know, Yoda showing up, you've got, like, Jar Jar Binks. That's how I feel. It's like, oh, this I'm not going to make a good guide. I'm not going to, and the guy's not going to be.
Let me assure you, you're far more attractive than Jar Jar Binks.
Thank you. I'll take it. But so how do I, as a 29-year-old, how do I communicate to a 45-year-old leader, business leader, or church leader, hey, like, somebody's here to find you. Like, I'm here to find you. Jesus is here to find you.
Right.
And, yeah.
Well, I don't know if this will be helpful, but here's what comes to mind. Jesus was 30 when he came to find Nicodemus, who by all record would have been an older guy. And Paul went out of his way to make sure that Timothy knew that he didn't let his youth shame him. The reality is that when the Spirit of God is upon us, we are called and commissioned to come and father and mother everybody that we have contact with. And any doubt that we have about that is the same doubt that the evil one would have wanted Jesus to be paying attention to in the desert, to which we say, my dad says something very different. And I think that's what I'll tell you.